Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, based in New York City, Ankit Panda, and joining me on today's podcast is my diplomat editorial colleague, Franz-Stefan Gadi, and we have a guest and diplomat contributor, Greg Austin. Thank you both for joining me. For those of you who don't know Greg, he is based in Canberra. He's a professorial fellow with the East-West Institute and a visiting professor at the Australian Defence Force Academy. For The Diplomat, he writes regularly on China's aircraft carriers, particularly with a focus on cyber issues and U.S.-China relations. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Ankit.
And the reason we have Greg on this week is because he was actually fortunate enough to attend the Shangri-La Dialogue last week in Singapore. For those who don't know, the Shangri-La Dialogue is an annual security summit Track 1.5, hosted by the IISS think tank. And this year's Shangri-La Summit focused very heavily on the South China Sea, as regular readers of The Diplomat will be unsurprised to learn. So, Greg, why don't you just start us off by telling us the ambiance at Shangri-La and what most participants ended up taking away from the meeting. We already have a good idea about what occurred, particularly Chinese Admiral Sun Jiangyou's comments, but I'd love for you to share your perspectives on what you felt you got out of the summit and what other participants did as well.
Yes, thanks, Ankit. Well, the first thing to remark is that the Shangri-La Dialogue is in fact an amazing event in and of itself. It brings together defense ministers and their peers from around the Asia-Pacific region. And on this occasion, it had defense ministers from the United Kingdom, Germany, and the EU High Representative for Foreign Policy. So in and of itself, the Shangri-La Dialogue is bigger than any of these little issues that emerge from time to time. And as the Singaporean Prime Minister said at the event, this is the promise of the region. It's one of consultation, one of getting together to resolve disputes. So that's the first thing to note. But the second thing to note is that there was this tension over the South China Sea, but some of my colleagues who participated last year said it was much calmer this year than last year. And even though we've seen this ramp up in activity in the South China Sea, that's quite worrying, apparently the heat in the discussion last year was more intense than this year. So that's a plus, if we can believe what they're saying.
And why do you think that was the case? One hypothesis that I've read some commentators state is that we have a few U.S.-China summits coming up with the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. We have President Xi Jinping's trip to the United States in late September. Do you think China and the United States are trying to keep things cool until they've had a chance to meet behind closed doors bilaterally?
Well, I don't think that the Chinese representatives or the United States representatives pulled any punches. And I thought U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter gave a very hard-hitting speech. One reason why it may have been less tense is that the things that were said at the summit by people like Ashton Carter had been said in the weeks before. So everyone was prepared. The Chinese had their prepared answers. So it was all, in a sense, a little bit predictable in that way. So, and I think perhaps people had taken a bit of a lesson from last year that, you know, it doesn't serve to get heated. Let's try and discuss positions in a calm and rational way. So I think that's perhaps an explanation.
Right. I also heard that Admiral Sun, he had a binder in front of him with tabs. So when it came around to the question and answer, instead of organically answering the questions and offering new insight, he essentially repeated the rehearsed positions we hear the foreign ministry spokespeople make. Was that correct?
Yeah, well, that was a little bit conspicuous and a little bit disappointing. But in a sense, that's the Chinese system. And it's a good sign, really, that Chinese diplomacy has got a long way to go in being able to deal correctly, effectively, and persuasively with these regional forums. And being in that sort of position where a senior PLA officer has to reach for the notes and just read out, the preferred answer is a reflection of the degree of maturity that is still ahead of China in its diplomacy.
Right. At the same time, there have been a few people praising China's transparency, particularly with its 2015 white paper on its military strategy. Franz, I hope this is something you can speak to too, because I know you wrote about it for us. But what is both your takes on this white paper? Franz, do you want to start and offer your thoughts on this?
Well, I think Greg also mentioned it in an article that he wrote for The Diplomat, but what I found most conspicuous is the prominent mentioning of cybersecurity for the importance of cybersecurity for the Chinese military and also at the same time this notion of active defense, which I think is quite an interesting concept and that not a lot of outsiders really can grasp, because I think it means something very different from the what we deem active defense in the West, perhaps. And I don't know, I'll let Greg jump in here.
Yes, well, I think on the maritime front, the white paper encapsulated what we knew about the evolution of Chinese foreign policy. But it did use a couple of terms of art, and there were some interesting new chapters in there. And Franz mentioned active defense as one. The other one was the idea that Chinese Navy would move from coastal waters to open seas operation, a combination of coastal waters and open seas operation. And that term, open seas, was not really defined. So the white paper does mark out some new directions in the way in which China presents its military strategy, so it's remarkable in that way. But in terms of what was really new, there were two things. One was the very high priority given to cyber operations. The paper said that cyberspace and outer space are now the commanding heights of international security. That was really important. But the other really important thing was the repeat insistence on the absolute authority and leadership of the Chinese Communist Party over the Chinese armed forces. And that was hammered home paragraph after paragraph. And that's really interesting to contemplate. It suggests that the Chinese leadership are having a bit of trouble getting the PLA to follow their instructions. And that's particularly relevant to a part of the white paper where they talked about the need to balance what they call rights protection, which is what the PLA is doing in the South China Sea, on the one hand, against what they call stability maintenance, which is cooperative diplomacy.
Right. We've seen some non-compliance with Beijing on the front lines. For example, last September when Xi Jinping visited India, we had that unexpected border incursion. And you'll note that right after his trip to India, Xi returned to Beijing. He convened all of the top leadership of the PLA and demanded their absolute loyalty. And similarly, one of, I believe, a prominent Chinese general at a military academy was sacked for corruption after he was found of aiding the rebels across the border in Myanmar. So there are definitely these issues where we see a disconnect between the military leadership and the party. But yet again, it's an important reminder that China's military isn't a professional military like we think of in the United, in the West, at least. It is the military arm of the CCP. And I thought that was very interesting in the white paper. I want to move back to the South China Sea and talk a bit about international law, which is a big topic that a lot of people have been writing about. It's been a very interesting debate. We have the Permanent Court of Arbitration case that the Philippines has brought against China regarding its claims that will enter deliberations later this summer, and hopefully we'll see a decision on that later this year or early next year. Greg, I wanted to ask you about China's relationship to international law in the South China Sea. So today, I saw a very interesting interview that Christian Amanpour on CNN did with Ambassador Kui Tiankai, China's ambassador in the United States. And in that interview, he claimed that the U.S. P-8 Poseidon flight over the South China Sea near, I believe, Fiery Cross Reef about 2 weeks ago contravened UNCLOS in both spirit and letter, which I thought was a bit of an interesting claim considering what China is doing in the region with its land reclamation. Could you speak a bit to how China, why China continues to use international law to justify its behavior in the South China Sea when, as I think, you know, most of us know, that these features that China is building man-made features on, turning into man-made islands, most of them under UNCLOS would qualify as low tide elevations at best and at worst, and rocks at best, which does not grant them a 200 nautical mile exclusion zone. So what is China's logic here with international law?
Sure. Well, I wrote a book on this in 1998. It's a 400-page analysis of this very question.
All right, we have about 10 minutes, I'll warn you.
But we have to understand that China has pursued international law quite well in its pursuit of its claims in the South China Sea. All claims to sea come from claims to territory. So we have to go back to China's claim to the Spratly Islands. We have to bear in mind that China is a littoral state of the South China Sea. It has about 6,000 kilometers of coastline bordering the South China Sea. So the proposition from implied in many American critiques that China's got no business in the South China Sea is quite crazy. So China is entitled to a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone from all of its coastal territory in the South China Sea, including from Hainan Island and its claimed Paracel Islands, which it disputes with Vietnam. China was the first country to occupy any of the Spratly Islands when forces of the Republican government of China in 1946 went to the Spratly Islands in 1946. It returned that occupation, the Taiwanese returned that occupation in 1956. So the China has a claim in the Spratly Islands, and the international community is obliged to recognize that claim, and rival claimants are obliged to work with China to settle that claim peacefully. What happened, in effect, was that in 1975, Vietnam sent its forces, the Unified State of Vietnam, sent its forces to occupy certain land features in the Spratly group. And then in the 1960s and 70s, the Philippines sent their forces. So by the time the Chinese decided that they should send some forces to occupy islands in the Spratly Islands, there were none left to occupy. So it had to then find submerged reefs and to plant these sort of rather awkward-looking buildings above the sea on poles to have any sort of presence on the ground in the South China, in the Spratly group. So it's that original claim to land territory that is driving everything. And the current focus on these artificial islands is very misplaced, because the China already claims EEZ jurisdiction based on its territorial claim to the Spratly Islands. It doesn't see the building of man-made islands as having any impact on those claims at all. So
that's a very interesting point. Absolutely. Franz, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to jump in here, and I wrote about this back in March 2015. Four U.S. senators sent a letter to the U.S. Secretaries of Defense and State highlighting China's alleged quote-unquote aggressive behavior and pushing its claims in the South China Sea. And their argument was that, at a minimum, China's behavior violates the 2002 Joint Sino-ASEAN Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the South China Sea, which stipulates that the signing parties should, quote-unquote, exercise self-constraint in the conduct of activities that would complicate or escalate disputes. Couldn't you at least make the case that China's behavior in the South China Sea is aggressive, Greg?
China's behavior in the South China Sea is no different from Vietnam's behavior in the South China Sea or the Philippines' behavior. So in what way is China's behavior different from those two parties? I think that's the important question. China may have more ships there, but Vietnam has its military forces in occupation of islands that are claimed by other countries. The Philippines has its military forces on islands that are claimed by it. So how is China's position different?
Well, I guess what a lot of policymakers in D.C. are saying is that it's the scope of Chinese activities that that makes the difference.
Yeah. Well, just to jump in here on this point, I think in my view, I think President Obama actually described China's behavior as aggressive yesterday, and I think it's very important for the United States to be very clear about what it calls this behavior. I would say assertion at best. Aggression, I think, should be reserved to describe events like we saw last summer, where Chinese Coast Guard ships were colliding with Vietnamese boats. That was an incident of coercion, of aggression. Similarly, the 2012 events in Scarborough Shoal. I think aggression would better describe those incidents, but I don't think that land reclamation can go that far. I would call it assertion at best. Sorry, Greg, go ahead.
You raise a good point, but we have to have a more critical eye on what the United States administration is saying all the way up to President Obama. The United States government is in the grip of some crazy hysteria about China, which is getting out of control, and that was the thrust of an article by my colleague at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Michael Swain, in the National Interest just this past week. I don't trust President Obama's instincts on China. And I think it's time for the international community to calmly analyze what's going on. The behavior of China in the South China Sea is no different from the behavior of the United Kingdom towards Iceland in the Cod Wars in the 1970s. The only difference is that the UK wasn't building artificial islands. And, these artificial islands by themselves, they were there, they've been there for like 10 or 15 years. The fact that China is now filling them in and putting an airstrip on one is really not is not aggression. It's not the end of the world. It's not the cause for war. It's just a small territorial claim about little rocks and islands. If people are dying, that's a different thing.
Well, if I can just jump in here, Greg, you said in one of your last pieces that diplomacy by the United States is actually working and that it's not served by exaggerating or inventing military threats such as that related to commercial shipping in the South China Sea. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, on the first point, people might say, well, U.S. diplomacy is not working, but let's look at the long term. So the United States really became actively engaged with this set of issues at least 20 years ago. And in that period, what we've seen from the Chinese is a greater capability to discuss these matters in terms of international law. The main breach or the main sort of discrepancy between current Chinese claims and international law is this nine dashed line, which the Chinese used in a submission on the extent of their maritime resource claims, which had to be submitted under the Law of the Sea Convention. And that's what the Philippines is currently challenging. So really what U.S. diplomacy has achieved in the last 20 years is that it's brought China and the region to a recognition of the broad principles of international law and the need to talk. Let me switch quickly to your second point. This idea that China has in any way threatens commercial shipping in the South China Sea is a fantasy invented by Japan and the Philippines 20 years ago and pursued vigorously by them ever since, to the point that they've now convinced most American commentators that it's some sort of reality. But as Michael Swain writes in the National Interest this last week, China has never indicated any threat or any harassment of civil shipping or commercial air traffic in the South China Sea ever. So what the foundation of that is, and there's all sorts of reasons why China wouldn't do it, because it brings all of the seaborne trade to China. So in a sense, what's the connection between this new exaggerated threat of supposedly to commercial shipping, which even the Australian Defence Minister repeated at the Shangri-La dialogue? What's the connection between that and United States diplomacy? United States diplomacy is not served by such an empty, exaggerated threat.
To push that point a bit, I'd actually bring up what I see to be a major dividing point between the United States and China rhetorically, and I think Swain touches on this in his piece as well. Carter recently, on his way over to Shangri-La, he stopped in Hawaii where he oversaw a change of command in PACOM, and he actually mentioned that there and in Shangri-La in his speech, he mentioned that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate in the South China Sea or wherever international law permits it to do so. And yet you see comments from the Chinese, again today in that same interview with Christian Amanpour, Ambassador Kui Tian Kai mentioned that the United States, the South China Sea shouldn't be an issue between China and the United States because the United States doesn't have any territorial claims there and it should be irrelevant for the United States. So there's this clear disconnect. China thinks the U.S. shouldn't care about the South China Sea because it doesn't have claims, but yet the United States claims that it's standing up for the freedom of navigation, it's standing up for its ability to operate its military in Asia. And I think that China clearly disagrees with that. And again, to go back to the white paper for a second, last year we had that comment by, I believe it was Wang Yang, the vice premier, who made this comment that China had neither the capability nor the intent to challenge the United States in Asia. But as per the white paper, I think we're seeing that that is incorrect. So I think that we're starting to see this friction between the U.S. and China in the South China Sea, not so much because of the commercial shipping issue, but because of the United States' determination to be able to operate its military in the region. What do you have to say about that, Greg?
Well, it's a good point. The United States, I agree totally with Defense Secretary Ashton Carter when he says that the United States has the right to fly over the high seas and sail over the high seas where it wants, when it wants. And in that respect, the Chinese don't agree with that position. And I think the United States position is right. But the dispute over the freedom of navigation has merged into some assumed threat to all navigation. So it's sort of, in a sense, semantically correct for the United States to say that China is hindering freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. But it, in a very unprincipled way, merges that and confuses it with the freedom of commercial shipping. This is United States diplomacy at its worst, where it's like the Iran nuclear issue. Whenever anyone talks about the Iran nuclear program, people who hear that are supposed to hear Iran's military nuclear program. Iran hasn't had a military nuclear program since 2003. So what, you know, we have to be very clear, and it's time for the United States to be much more responsible and to make very clear this distinction between freedom of navigation operations by its armed forces and any putative threat to commercial shipping. I do think that's the main point of dispute here, and the fear that's being generated around the region that there is a threat to commercial shipping is just highly irresponsible.
Right, I agree with that. It actually goes back to the broader point where the United States and China have a very public disagreement about the ability of states to conduct surveillance activities, military surveillance within an exclusive economic zone. China clearly disagrees with that, but the United States obviously has the opposite interpretation. Although China has spied on the United States within its own exclusive economic zone, I believe, at RIMPAC 2014, as we saw.
That's the main point of difference, and it's a contest over a principle. I think UNCLOS does not prohibit the United States activities in the way that China says it does, but that's a different point. It's about the military surveillance of another country in peacetime. You know, these countries are not at war; they're not enemies. You know, people should stop talking as if, you know, these are enemies. And Michael Swain makes the point that, you know, these leading figures in the United States Armed Forces are now saying we're ready for war tonight. I mean, that is the craziest thing I've heard, and not from Michael, but I mean, the idea that these American officers, I mean, when the changeover occurred at SINCPAC, one of the American officers said from the platform, the same platform as Ashton Carter, that the Chinese claims in the South China Sea are preposterous. Well, I'm afraid the U.S. admiral who said that is a little bit preposterous himself, because the Chinese claims are no different from the Vietnamese claims.
Right. So how do we de-escalate here? I mean, the Global Times has been saying in China there was that op-ed that's being cited widely. I actually haven't been able to find the original link on that, but the op-ed that the Global Times is saying that if the U.S. wants China to stop its activities in the South China Sea, war is inevitable, and I quote that. And that's terrifying when you hear that U.S. military officials are saying that they're ready for a fight tonight with China. So how do we de-escalate this? Does China have to come to the table with a clarification of its nine-dash line? Does the United States have to come to the table with sort of an acknowledgement that China's claims in the South China Sea are legitimate, a combination of both? What's your take, Greg?
Well, I think the most important thing is for China to demilitarize its activities in the South China Sea. So, for example, in the East China Sea, China and Japan have stopped using military vessels a long time ago. They use Coast Guard vessels. So it would be a really good sign if China stopped using PLA Navy ships in the South China Sea and only used Coast Guard ships. And took away any pretense of military readiness. So, you know, the idea that the Chinese should challenge the United States for overflight of an artificial reef or an artificial island is crazy. China shouldn't do that. It is provocative. On the other hand, I think the United States has got to admit in public that that China is a littoral state on the South China Sea. It does have legitimate interest in historical dispute over the Spratly Islands. The United States shouldn't endorse China's claim in any way, but it should admit that there is at least a dispute. I think that's really important. What we're seeing, in effect, are people in the Pentagon using China's erratic behavior as an excuse for all sorts of ugly things.
Mm-hmm. Just to push back a bit on you, on that point on the Coast Guard vessels, you know, I mean, China considers its Coast Guard, its white-hulled vessels, as its second navy. It's recognized that other states, you know, states that abide by the status quo interpret a clear difference between the gray-hulled ships of a navy and the white-hulled ships of a Coast Guard. So it's effectively been using its Coast Guard to carry out coercive activities. I mean, as we saw last summer, it was Chinese Coast Guard vessels that were colliding and, you know, using water hoses to terrorize Vietnamese ships. So will that really cause a de-escalation in the region, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd push back. Mm-hmm. The interaction, those sorts of collisions between ships and use of water hoses is not coercion by anybody's definition under international law. It's not aggression by anybody's definition under international law. You know, these things are exactly what Britain did to Iceland in 1970s. It's normal for a territorial dispute. What do we expect China to do? Do nothing? I mean, what's your answer to that, Ankit, I wonder? You know, what should China do? Should it just sit back while all of these other claimants exercise their sovereignty over the disputed territory? Because that was what was happening before 1988.
Well, so, I mean, I think that's a separate issue, right? Like, that can apply to the land reclamation activities, which I acknowledge are not aggressive or coercive in any way. That is an assertion of China, whatever the claims China thinks it has, and other states have done that in the region. But my preference, you know, my answer to that would be that I would prefer that China stick by the 2002 declaration on the conduct of parties with between it and ASEAN and pursue a sustainable negotiation process towards a code of conduct, which is actually another thing I meant to ask you. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I agree totally. But the you know, the combination of language like coercion or aggression with these incidents at sea, which are quite normal in these sorts of territorial disputes, is really overinflating the importance of the disputes. You know, China is wrong in its erratic behavior. It's wrong in militarization of the dispute. But, you know, it is not the threat that people say it is. You know, and it's time for the Philippines, for Vietnam, and for China to sit down and meet their obligations under international law for the peaceful resolution of disputes. And all external parties should stay out of that.
Right. One thing that I wanted to talk to both of you about that I haven't seen a lot of writing on, honestly, is the fact that this land reclamation that has already occurred and the facilities that China has already set up and the military assets and the troops that are already there on these features in the South China Sea, I find it very difficult to believe that they will ever go away, they will ever leave, they will ever be dismantled, regardless of international law, whatever. I mean, outside of a kinetic conflict, of a war, I don't see this changing. So I think China has succeeded in changing the status quo in the South China Sea in a big way. Now, the United States has to accept this as a reality, I see. I mean, you know, where are these – you know, these aren't going anywhere. So what do you think the longer-term impact of these facilities being there is going to be on China's relations with ASEAN, with the United States going forward? And that's for either of you, really.
Well, I think that the we have to understand that the land being reclaimed is not a new on a new artificial feature. So all China is doing is filling in and reclaiming land on undersea features that they already occupy. So in that respect, there is no change. There is no expansion of China's activity in the South China Sea. They're changing the character of some of these facilities from being almost in uninhabitable little shacks on poles to being habitable islands, being able to be serviced by aircraft. These reclaimed islands with an airfield can pose some sort of low-level military threat. And that's what's really annoying people. And I think China's got to take away the idea that these are military facilities. And I think in that respect, China has made a mistake. If China is interested in stability maintenance, it should take away the military dimension of what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. Franz, yes. I'll let you ask the final question.
Wanted to add one more thing to this. I think if those islands are permanently inhabited, I think it, you know, you could make the argument that that would, you know, constitute active governance of those islands, which would substantially help China claim that the islands are inhabitable under UNCLOS, which in turn would bolster any Chinese claims to an exclusive economic zone in the South China Sea, right? So I think
Let me take issue with that. China already claims an exclusive economic zone around the Spratly Islands. So it can't claim any more because of these these artificial reefs. You know.
Okay.
That's a fair point. Yeah, and I should just clarify that under UNCLOS, man-made features, be they on rocks, be they on low tide elevations, are not entitled to any sort of exclusive economic zone or territorial water.
Yeah,
only rocks are entitled to that.
Yeah. And the reality is, which China fully recognizes, that any determination of a country's EEZ is not an absolute thing that is determined unilaterally. Where exclusive economic zones overlap, as they do between any putative Philippines EEZ and any putative Chinese EEZ from the Spratly Islands, that's a subject for negotiation between the two sides. There's not some pre-existing absolute right to 200 nautical miles of territorial sea, to 200 nautical miles of EEZ from any land feature where there's an overlap, that's completely up for debate and negotiation. So the proposition that China is conducting activities in Philippines EEZ is just absolute international legal nonsense, because there's no Philippines EEZ until the Philippines and China negotiate one.
Absolutely. And we'll all be looking forward to see the results of this case with the Permanent Court of Arbitration, even though China said that it completely disregards the legitimacy of that process. Anyways, Greg, that's all the time we have for this evening's podcast. Thank you so much for joining us and providing your insight.
You're very welcome. A little firm, but spirited is good.
Absolutely. No, it's great to have somebody that believes in that this is completely overblown and the U.S. and China might be missing the forest for the trees here in the South China Sea. For those of you who listen regularly, we've had Greg on in the past. We had an absolutely fascinating conversation last time about aircraft carriers. So if you're interested in that, I'd recommend you to go back and listen to that episode. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes and let us know about the kinds of content and guests you'd like to see on. As far as Greg goes, he's a regular contributor at The Diplomat, so keep an eye on our Asia Defense blog for his latest musings on U.S.-China relations, Chinese cyber issues, and all sorts of other security-related topics. Thank you both for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Ankit. Thanks, friends.